And I'm back to read to you Hitler's War by David Irving. This chapter is called Pact with the Devil. To his adjutants, Hitler truculently claimed that he wanted only to be allowed his first Silesian War, and nothing more. He would explain to his commanders that from now on the German public would just have to get used to fighting. The Polish campaign would be a good introduction. On August 18th, he had word telephoned to Dr. Goebbels in Berlin to turn up the propaganda volume to full blast by Tuesday, the 22nd. With Poland totally isolated by the Nazi-Soviet pact, Hitler was jubilant. He phoned Goebbels on the 22nd, and the minister congratulated him on his masterstroke. He still had no clear idea of the consequence of events after White. No doubt the goddess of fortune would see to that. All that was constant was his long-term goal, the goal that he had set out in Mein Kampf in 1924, in secret to his commanders-in-chief on February 22, 1933, again on November 5, 1937, May 28, 1938, and more recently in his secret speeches of January and February 1939. White was just one more step toward Germany's 300-year-old dream of a Reich ruling Central and Eastern Europe, and thereby dominating the world. What means were not justified to that end? What means were not justified to that end? Britain, he would cajole and win with blandishments. He would offer his Wehrmacht to defend her far-flung empire against the Asiatic hordes and other predators. Germany's other neighbors, Hitler would cheat, threaten, bribe, or deceive. As a private person, I would never break my word, he would confide to Huell in June 1941. But if it is necessary for Germany, then 1,000 times. Without waiting for Stalin's reply, he had already ordained on the 19th that all his senior commanders were to meet him 3 days later at the Berghof. The invitation issued by the OKW emphasized he particularly wants the conference to remain absolutely secret and no word whatsoever to leak to the foreign press. It would be disguised as a harmless tea party, with half the guests fetched by Hitler's motor pool from Salzburg, and half from Munich. All were to come in plain clothes. When he appeared in the Great Hall at noon on August 22nd, Hitler found about 50 officers arrayed in 4 or 5 rows of chairs, army group and army commanders, their chiefs of staff and their navy and air force equivalents. Prominently to the fore was Field Marshal Hermann Goering, who had interpreted the words plain clothes as less literally than the others. He was wearing a sleeveless green leather jerkin with thick yellow buttons over a white silk blouse, while his ample lower extremities were sheathed in gray knickerbockers and long gray stockings. A gold dagger dangled nonchalantly from an exotic sword belt. Hitler spread out his outline notes on the grand piano and launched into his first speech. His argument was simple but persuasive. The Wehrmacht was about to embark on White, a campaign they could not lose. There was no time like the present. Neither he nor Mussolini would live forever. At any moment I might be struck down by a criminal or lunatic. He had no fears of any second front. Britain and France might posture menacingly, but they would not really fight. Hitler then described how he had set the ball rolling toward rapprochement with Stalin by this particularly cordial welcome for the visit for the Soviet ambassador at the New Year's reception. That same evening, he said, the ambassador expressed his thanks to me for this and for not having given him second-class treatment at the reception. With a gesture toward Ribbentrop, he announced triumphantly that the foreign minister was flying to Moscow immediately to sign the pact. Now I have Poland just where I want her. Now Germany could not be blockaded because the USSR would supply all the cereals, cattle, coal, wood, lead, and zinc that Germany needed. I am only afraid that at the last moment some Schweinhund might put me to a plan for mediation. A buffet lunch was served on the terraces. Afterward, Hitler spoke for another hour as a storm gathered outside the big picture window. He adjured the commanders to display an iron nerve, even if Britain and France prepared for war. Each and every one of you must act as though we have all along been spoiling for a fight with the Western powers as well. It was vital to crush every living spark out of Poland rapidly, if needed, brutally. I shall provide a propaganda motive for launching this war, whether plausible or not. The victor is not challenged afterward as to whether he has told the truth. Hitler concluded with the appeal, "I have done my duty. Now go out and do yours." Goering rose, importantly, mounted three shallow steps, and assured the Führer that the Wehrmacht would do its duty. Brauchitsch confidently dismissed his generals with these words, "Gentlemen, to your stations!" The Luftwaffe generals Milch and Kesselring were seen in a broad good humor. Only Admiral Raeder came briefly to remind Hitler of the vulnerability of a sea cadet ship permanently berthed in the Gulf of Danzig. The Führer was overheard to reply, "What if the old tub goes down?" The Grand Admiral coldly reminded him that there were several hundred sea cadets on board. It was the only time he saw the Führer in these last remaining days of peace. Ribbentrop set out that afternoon for Moscow, armed with Hitler's private instructions to yield to every Soviet demand, if necessary, to secure Molotov's signature. Ribbentrop was to deny any German interest in southeastern Europe, right down to Constantinople and the Dardanelles Straits. That evening, August 22nd, he repeated that his only real fear was that some imbecile might oblige him by subtle proposals to give way again. This was no idle fear, since about August 16th, the FA had been monitoring furtive phone conversations between the British ambassador in Berlin and Sir Horace Wilson in London. Wilson was searching desperately for a formula that would give Danzig back to the Reich. On August 20th, he had secretly told the German press attaché in London that he was willing to come secretly to Germany if need be. Late on August 22nd, the British ambassador phoned, asking to see the Führer the next day. He had a personal letter from the British Prime Minister to Hitler. "It defines our position exactly," the FA wiretap quoted Henderson as saying. How we are bound by our obligations to the Poles, and how we shall live up to these obligations, should Poland be attacked. According to the wiretap, the Chamberlain letter would propose a cooling-off period while the questions of Danzig and the German minority in Poland were settled. By the time Henderson reached the Berghof with this letter at noon on the 23rd, Hitler had already drafted a reply. Wiesacker wrote in his diary, "The Führer's purpose is to bully the British government into dropping its guarantee obligations to Poland." When Henderson tried to explain that Britain was bound to honor her obligations, Hitler coarsely replied, "Then honor them! If you hand out blank checks, you must expect to have to pay out on them." He asked Henderson to come back later that afternoon to collect his reply to Chamberlain. Before returning at 3 p.m., Henderson telephoned his Berlin embassy from Salzburg. "I hope to be back in Berlin by about 8 p.m., the FA wiretappers heard him report. "He," that is Hitler, "is entirely uncompromising and unsatisfactory, but I can't say anything further until I've received his written reply. Roughly, the points made by him were, Poland has been warned that any further action against German nationals and any move against Danzig, including economic strangulation, will be met by immediate German action. If Britain takes further mobilization measures, general mobilization will take place in Germany. I asked whether this was a threat. His reply was, no, a measure of protection." Hitler's written answer was intransigent. In their second conversation that afternoon, Henderson argued that it was proof of Chamberlain's good intentions that he was still refusing to take Churchill into his cabinet. The anti-German faction in Britain mainly consisted of Jews and anti-Nazis, he said. After he left the Berghof, Wiesacker caught Hitler briefly alone and warned that Italy was only lukewarm about war. While the British were the captives of their own foreign policy, Britain and France are bound to declare war. They aren't people you can deal with logically or systematically. They're laboring under a psychosis, a kind of whiskey intoxication. Tomorrow, Chamberlain will rally the whole parliament behind him the moment he talks of war. Hitler disagreed, though evidently without conviction, because Wiesacker noted that day, "He still thinks he can localize the war, but he's also talking, today at any rate, of being able to fight a general war as well." Until recently, his view on this was very different. Alone, or in the company of his adjutants, Hitler paced the Berghof terraces. Goebbels flew down from Berlin. "The Führer," he recorded, "greets me very cordially. He wants me to be with him for the next few days. In the afternoon, he gives me a broad overview of the situation. Poland's plight is desperate. We shall attack her at the first possible opportunity. The Polish state must be smashed just like the Czech. It won't take much effort. More difficult is the question whether the West will intervene. At present, one can't say. It depends. London is still talking. London is talking tougher than in September 1938, so we're going to have to box cunning. At present, Britain probably doesn't want war, but she can't lose face. Italy isn't keen, but she'll probably go along with us. She's hardly got any choice." Late that evening, Ribbentrop came faintly on the telephone from Moscow. "Stalin is demanding that the tiny but ice-free ports of Libau and Windau in Latvia should be assigned to his sphere of interest. Hitler sent an orderly for an atlas and replied that the USSR was welcome to the ports concerned. Later, still at dinner, a paper was handed to him. Hitler excitedly rapped the table for silence and announced that the pact with Stalin had been signed. After dinner, the whole party strolled out onto the darkened terraces. Across the valley, the night sky was lightened by a phenomenon not normally seen in these southern latitudes, an aurora borealis of bloody red." He sat up with Goebbels and several others until 4 a.m., talking things over. He had now decided that white should begin at 4:30 a.m. on the 26th. The second phase, the Y movement, had just begun at 8 p.m. 1,300 trainloads of material and troops were moving eastward, and 1,700 toward the west. Raeder's warships were already at sea. Across the Atlantic, a German supply ship, the Altmark, was just weighing anchor to rendezvous with the German raider Graf Spee. What could still go wrong? Wiesacker wrote in his diary that evening, August 24th, "Italy is acting as the whole affair does not concern her. The thought that Hitler may have to fight the West is causing him more concern than I suspected." At 3:30 p.m., Hitler and Goebbels had flown back to Berlin to meet Ribbentrop, who would arrive back at Tempelhof Airport from Moscow at 6:45. In Berlin, sobering news awaited him. Chamberlain had just publicly reaffirmed in the reconvened House of Commons that Britain planned to stand by her guarantee to Poland, despite the Moscow Pact. Hitler analyzed the position with Ribbentrop, Goering, and Wiesacker. Ribbentrop was full of his impressions of the Kremlin. Stalin, he said, had toasted each member of the German delegation in turn. "Stalin is just like you, mein Führer," Ribbentrop gushed. "He's extraordinarily mild, not like a dictator at all." More cursorily, they discussed Italy. Hitler still ignored every sign that his Axis partner was ill-disposed toward war. The only risk that Hitler would admit was that the Italians might bluster that events had taken an unexpected turn. So after midnight, he had Ribbentrop telephone Counciano to advise him that white was now imminent. To Ribbentrop and Hitler, it seemed a pure formality. They assured Ciano that the Moscow Pact would rule out any Western intervention. When Hitler rose the next morning, August 25th, 1939, his official residence was already crowded. White was now less than 24 hours away. The brown Nazi Party uniform was everywhere. Everyone knew that at 2 p.m. Hitler was due to give the code word, and none of his followers wanted to miss the historic moment. The photographs show Bormann, Goebbels, Ribbentrop, and Himmler all hanging around. Telephone wires snaked across the priceless carpets in tangled profusion. Ribbentrop dictated by telephone a formal letter from the Führer to Mussolini hinting that war might come at any hour. Hitler asked for an early response. By noon there was still no reply, so he inquired of the OKW how long he could postpone the attack decision. The general staff agreed to a one-hour extension until 3. Hitler invited Ambassador Henderson to come over at 1:30. Wiesacker observed in his diary, "Most of the day in the Reich Chancellery. Efforts are still being made to split the British from the Poles." At 12:30 p.m., Lieutenant Colonel Nicholas von Vormann reported to Hitler as liaison officer. Colonel Erwin Rommel reported as commandant of the Führer HQ. Hitler sent him on ahead with the HQ unit to Bad Polzin, a railroad station in Pomerania, where Bock's Army Group North had established its HQ. Captain von Puttkamer also arrived back at the Chancellery. The Admiralty had apprehensively recalled him from the destroyer force to act as a naval adjutant. Hitler took him aside to talk about his destroyer experiences until 1:15, when Bormann announced that lunch was served. Barely had Hitler settled with his 9-man staff at the round lunch table when a roll of drums from the courtyard heralded the arrival of Sir Neville Henderson. For over an hour, speaking with apparent sincerity, Hitler put to the ambassador the folly of Britain's throwing away her empire for Poland's sake. He followed with his now familiar offer. After he had settled with the Polish problem, he was willing to conclude agreements with Britain, which would, if necessary, assure the British Empire of German assistance, regardless of where such assistance should be necessary. He offered partial disarmament and even hinted that if Britain waged a sham war to preserve face, he would not begrudge it. Once the war was over, he would return to his beloved architecture. "I'm not really a politician at all," he said. The FA intercepts show that Henderson was not taken in. He reported in cipher to London that it was plain to him that Hitler was trying to drive a wedge between Britain and Poland. There was still no formal reply from Mussolini, but the FA had now intercepted Count Ciano's instructions to the Italian ambassador to see Ribbentrop at once and inform him of the Duce's statement in the event of war. "If Germany attacks Poland and the conflict remains localized, Italy will afford Germany any kind of political and economic aid requested to her." To Hitler, this seemed satisfactory. When Italico thereupon asked urgently for an audience, he was asked to come at 2 p.m. Italico had to wait while Hitler talked with Henderson, and even as he waited, he was urgently informed by Rome that his instructions had been cancelled. Hitler sent Ribbentrop out impatiently to telephone Ciano. The word from Rome was that Ciano and Mussolini had both left for the beach. It was now 2:45 p.m. There were only 15 minutes to go to the General Staff's deadline. Hitler crossed the music room with Ribbentrop and closed the door behind them. After 15 minutes, Hitler decided he could not wait for the Duce's reply any longer. At 3:02 p.m., pale but otherwise composed, he opened the door and announced to the throng, "Case White!" So the attack would begin the next morning. Hitler's special train, America, was shunted to Anhalt station to await him. Telegrams went out to every Reichstag deputy ordering an emergency session at 5 the next morning. The public telephones to London and Paris were cut off. From Balkach's headquarters, the 3:02 p.m. code word was cabled, teletyped, telephoned, and duplicated. Camouflage was stripped, engines tested, ammunition cases broken open, for at 8:30 that evening, the advance toward the Polish frontier would begin. 1-2 hours passed. Suddenly, one of the many telephones rang. A voice said that the British government was going to ratify its pact with Poland that evening. The news had come from the press office. Ribbentrop urged Hitler to halt the attack, but Hitler was no dilettante. He knew that an army is an amorphous and fluid animal, with many brains and many claws. He summoned Colonel Schmunt. Schmunt called for General Keitel. Keitel sent for General von Brauchitsch, but he was nowhere to be found. Schmunt fetched the OKW timetable. The long pages were unfurled and calculations made. It seemed there was still time. Even as they were talking, at about 6 p.m., the Italian ambassador hurried in. He brought a further bombshell, the reply from Rome. Mussolini attached such fearful conditions to any Italian aid, for instance, immediate war material and raw material deliveries from Germany, and it was couched in such language, "I consider it my absolute duty as a loyal friend to tell you the whole truth," that Hitler could only treat it as a stinging rebuff. To Colonel von Vormann he hissed, "Cunning! That's what we've got to be now, as cunning as foxes." He was stunned. Goebbels saw him brooding and thinking things over. It's a hard blow for him, but he'll find a way out, even from this devilish situation. He's always found one before, and he'll do so this time, too. Hitler ordered the army colonel to summon his chiefs Brauchitsch and Halder, chief of general staff, to the building. But Halder was on the road somewhere with his entire operational staff, transferring from the War Department in Bendlerstrasse to General Staff AQ at Zossen, outside Berlin. Brauchitsch arrived at Hitler's residence at 7 p.m., sober and unexcitable, and he agreed that White could be postponed. In fact, he welcomed the delay, as it would shift the emphasis to a properly planned mobilization. He now told Hitler, "Give me a week to complete mobilization as planned, and you'll have over 100 divisions available. Besides, this way you gain time for your political maneuvering," he promised. "I can halt the army before it hits the frontier at 4:30 a.m. At 7:45 p.m., Vormann was dispatched by car to rush the written halt order personally to Halder. When Hitler telephoned Goering, the field marshal asked him how long he intended to postpone White. Hitler replied, "Very significantly. I'll have to see whether we can eliminate this British intervention." Goering was skeptical. "Do you really think 4 or 5 days will change things much?" Hitler appeared downstairs looking more relaxed on August 26th. The news was that the army had managed to halt its attack on Poland, virtually in mid-leap. The halt order had reached all but one army patrol. It had attacked Poland by itself and suffered accordingly. A small task force of Abwehr agents under Lieutenant Herzner sent to into Poland ahead of 0 hour to hold up the Jablonka railroad tunnels could not be recalled. A pathetic message came that they were now being encircled by regular Polish troops. Hitler ordered the little band of desperados to hold out as long as possible. To the Polish authorities, meanwhile, the Germans coolly disowned Herzner's force as an irresponsible Slovakian gang. Heydrich's planned provocations in Upper Silesia were called off at the last moment. The Polish corpses supplied by Dachau were given a reprieve. A telegram had arrived during the night from the German ambassador in Rome. It described vividly Mussolini's response at 3:20 p.m. the previous day on reading Hitler's first letter. The Duce had emphatically stressed that he would stand unconditionally at Hitler's side. That tallied with the first version of his reply as intercepted by the FA. Italy's attitude had, however, dramatically changed. At 11:52 a.m., the Forschungsamt intercepted Count Ciano's telephone call from Rome to Italico in Berlin, dictating what he described as Mussolini's demands from Germany. 150 flak batteries, millions of tons of coal, steel, and oil, and impossible quantities of molybdenum, 600 tons, tungsten, zirconium, and titanium. At noon, Keitel, Brauchitsch, and Goering came. Keitel confirmed that the OKW saw no prospect whatever of meeting the Italian demands. At about 1:30 p.m., Italico brought the list. New was Italico's demand that all the material must reach Italy before the beginning of hostilities. Italico complacently assured Hitler that all the figures were correct. At 2:30 p.m., Huell phoned Ambassador von Mackensen in Rome to verify the figures with Ciano. Ciano also insisted that there was no possibility of error. Mackensen was then instructed to see Mussolini and show him the figures, an instruction he found puzzling since the figures were supposed to have emanated from the Duce in the first place. Controlling his anger, Hitler began drafting yet another letter to Mussolini. He said he would do what he could to meet the demands. Where the Italians had asked only for flak batteries, Hitler proposed in his early draft to promise them flak battalions, Abteilungen. Goering was shocked and objected that was quite out of the question. Hitler cynically replied, "I'm not concerned with actually making the deliveries, but with depriving Italy of any excuse to wiggle out of her obligations." Shortly before lunch, General Milch arrived from Carenhall. It was he who candidly suggested that Italy's benevolent neutrality would be far better during White. Hitler slapped his thigh and brightened. The letter that was finally telephoned to Rome at 3 p.m. reflected this change of emphasis. Hitler asked only that Italy should make sufficient military clatter to contain some of the West's forces. Who needed Italian military assistance anyway? Mussolini confirmed that evening that since Germany could not supply the materials he had requested, Italy herself could not actively participate. Hitler replied with two lame requests. He asked his friend not to give the world any clue to Italy's disappointing attitude, and he asked for Italian industrial and agricultural workers for the Reich. Mussolini readily agreed. That day, the FA intercepted a report by the Italian embassy in Berlin. Canaris had gleefully described to his crony, the military attaché, how Hitler had revoked White on the previous evening. Hitler angrily sent for his devious intelligence chief and reprimanded him for his inexplicable talkativeness. France's faint-heartedness was apparent in a letter from the Prime Minister Edouard Daladier, which the ambassador brought to Hitler at 7 p.m. that evening, August 26th. You were like me, a soldier in the front lines the last war. You will know, as I do, what contempt and condemnation the devastations of war aroused in the consciences of nations, regardless of how the war ended. Colandre followed the letter with an emotional speech begging the Führer, who had built a whole empire without bloodshed, to hesitate before shedding the blood of women and children now. Hitler remained silent and kicked himself later for not having advised Colandre that, since he would never start the bombing of civilians, he would not be to blame if the blood of women and children flowed. Colandre telephoned to Daladier in Paris that the message had fallen on deaf ears. Daladier responded, "Then I put my trust in God and the strength of the French nation." The FA recorded the exchange. Unlike September 1938, this time the voices against war were in the minority. The Army General Staff anticipated White with barely disguised relish. The only influential voice of warning that of Goering was not heeded. Goering was maintaining contacts with high British officials, though through intermediaries and a Swedish businessman, Birger Delerus, that morning, August 26th, Lord Halifax had given Delerus a letter for Goering. It confirmed the British desire for a peaceful settlement, but stressed the need for a few days to reach it. Was this again the spirit of appeasement? It required the most cunning cultivation. Hitler asked Delerus to join them, gave him several proposals to convey to London, and sent him back. Afterward, he lay awake in the darkness of his chancellery bedroom and brooded on whether to take the plunge now or postpone this war for 2 years more. All his instincts told him that he must attack now. Admittedly, the FA intercepts showed little sign of the Western powers ditching Poland yet, but perhaps they were counting on Hitler backing down again, as he had on the 25th. It was now Sunday, August 27th. A flak battery mounted guard on the Adlon Hotel, where most of the Reichstag deputies were staying. During the day, the Nazi wiretappers heard a Holman, the secretary of the absent British ambassador, reassuring an American colleague that Henderson was urging London to avoid a war. But Holman predicted that Polish truculence might still be a big obstacle. Goebbels brought his state secretary Leopold Gutterer, wearing the black uniform of an SS Brigadefuhrer, and bearing a one-page propaganda ministry report on German public opinion. The public was unanimously against war. Hitler was furious, but Himmler backed Gutterer, saying that the Gestapo reports were painting the same grim picture. "It is very grave," recorded Goebbels, "but the Führer will pull us through. On Poland, our minimum demand is Danzig and a corridor across their corridor. Maximum, that's a matter of record. The Führer can't abandon our minimum demand, and he'll get his way. It's become a matter of honor. Nobody can say what will transpire. The Führer is glad we don't have a monarchy anymore. The Italy business has been declared top state secret. Death penalty for treason." Hitler finally met the disgruntled Reichstag deputies in the ambassador's suite of the Chancellery at 5:30 p.m. They recognized that he had spent a sleepless night. His voice was hoarse and his movements and expressions were loose and disjointed. Bormann noted in his diary, "For the time being, the Reichstag will not sit." After a brief speech, the Reichstag deputies were sent home by the Führer. Hitler told them that things looked grave, but he had resolved to settle the Eastern problems so oder so. His minimum demand was for the return of Danzig and a solution of the corridor problem. His maximum demand was for whatever a war would bring him. And he would fight that war with the most brutal and inhuman methods. Like Frederick the Great, he was willing to stake everything on one gamble. Mussolini's attitude was, he suggested, in their best interests. War would be hard, perhaps even hopeless, but as long as I live, there will be no talk of capitulation. He regretted that his pact with Stalin had been so widely misinterpreted. The USSR was no longer a Bolshevik state, he argued, but an authoritarian military dictatorship like their own. He had made a pact with the devil to drive out Beelzebub. If any one of you believes that my actions have not been inspired by my devotion to Germany, I give him the right to shoot me down. The deputies applauded, but only thinly. Food rationing was introduced on August 28, 1939, without warning. The rationing was evident at Hitler's own breakfast table that morning, but he came downstairs in a brilliant mood, because he had learned during the night that the Swedish businessman Dahlerus had returned from London with news that the British were seriously considering his offer. Hitler boasted to his staff that he had managed to knock Britain out of the game. When Brauchitsch reported to him, Hitler made no bones about his strategy. He would demand Danzig right of transit. He would demand Danzig right of transit across the Polish corridor, and a Tsar-type plebiscite there. Britain would probably accept these proposals. Poland would reject them, and the split would then be wide open. Hitler instructed the foreign ministry to draft a set of formal proposals along these lines for the British government to study. The proposals, 16 in all, were so moderate that one of his diplomats termed it a real League of Nations document. He read them out to Keitel in the conservatory. The general naively replied, "I find them astoundingly moderate." At 3:22 p.m., Brauchitsch telephoned the general staff from the chancellery to the effect that the provisional new date was September 1st. Colonel von Vormann wrote that afternoon, "Hitler is in a brilliant mood. He's confident that we can position Britain so that we only have Poland to deal with. Everybody's guessing at what Henderson is bringing back with him. He took off from London at 4:30 p.m. Not a hint has reached us so far." Henderson arrived at 10:30 p.m. Meissner and Bruckner conducted him to the Führer's study. He handed over the British reply to Hitler's offer of the 25th. It was not what Hitler expected at all. The British announced that they had received a definite assurance from the Poles that they were prepared to negotiate. Hitler replied that he was still minded to deal with Poland on a very reasonable basis, no doubt thinking of the still unrevealed 16-point proposals. He told Henderson that he would examine the British reply for the next day. Henderson assured him, "We took 2 days to formulate our answer. I am in no hurry." "But I am," said Hitler. Asterisk. Henderson, wrote Colonel von Vormann the next day, "did not bring what we expected, at least so they say. What follows now lies darkly in the future's womb." And back up. A fragment of Heinrich Himmler's typescript diary casts an unsavory shaft of light on the tenebrous inner workings of Hitler's mind that evening. Ambassador Henderson came to see the Führer at 10:30 p.m. and left the Reich Chancellery at 11:45 p.m. Afterward, Goering, Hess, Bodenschatz, and I joined the Führer in the conservatory. The Führer was accompanied by Ribbentrop. He told us what the British offer contained. It was very courteously phrased, but contained nothing of real substance. Altogether, he was in a very good mood, and mimicked in his inimitable way what Henderson had put forward, speaking German with a thick accent. The Führer then indicated that we now have to aim a document at the British, or Poles. That is little less than a masterpiece of diplomacy. He wants to spend tonight thinking it over, because he always gets most of his best ideas in the small hours between 5 and 6 a.m. At this, Goering inquired, "Mein Gott, you don't get any sleep even now. Or have you got insomnia again?" The Führer replied that he often dozes from 3 to 4 o'clock in the morning and then suddenly wakes up to find the problems arrayed in pristine clarity before his eyes. Then he jumps up and jots down a few keywords in pencil. He himself doesn't know how it happens. All he does know is that in the wee hours of the morning, everything that might confuse or distract disappears. Sure enough, by the time Hitler awoke the next morning, August 29th, his stratagem was clear. he would accept the British proposals for negotiations with Poland, but he would give Warsaw just one day to send a plenipotentiary to Berlin. They would, of course, refuse. Alternatively, if they agreed on the 30th, the Pole would have to arrive the next day. The next day, the talks would break down, and on September 1st, White could begin as planned. As an Abwehr colonel noted in his diary, the Führer has told Ribbentrop, Himmler, Bodenschatz, etc., tonight I am going to hatch something diabolical for the Poles, something they'll choke on. Wiesacker, equally well informed, wrote soon after 3 a.m. in his diary, Goering has told the Führer, let's stop trying to break the bank, to which the Führer retorted, it's the only game I've ever played, breaking banks. The reply that Hitler handed to the British ambassador at 7 p.m. reflected his new stratagem. It said that he would approve of direct negotiations with Warsaw, and counted on the arrival of a Polish plenipotentiary the next day. He would also agree to guarantee Poland's new frontiers, but only in association with the Soviet government. Henderson objected, this sounds very much like an ultimatum. Hitler replied that it would only take 90 minutes for a Pole to fly to Berlin from Warsaw. My soldiers are asking me yes or no. To underline the point, Henderson found Keitel outside the study as he left. He ironically asked, busy today, Herr General Obst? General Oberst? On August 30th, Hitler conferred all afternoon with his commanders in chief, except, of course, Raeder, who was still sulking over the Albrecht affair. His timetable now allowed little leeway. He was sure that no Polish plenipotentiary would arrive, and the FA wiretaps on the British embassy revealed that London shared that view. Henderson was heard at 11 a.m. complaining, you can't just conjure up a Polish representative from out of the hat. Soon after 5 p.m., a strange FA wiretap report reached Hitler. The British Foreign Office had telephoned Henderson that Neville Chamberlain was less impressed than his ambassador by the clamor arising from the Reich Chancellery, as he's been over there himself, and by implication knew these people. The voice, speaking from the London end, continued that they are really on the right track now. They, that is the Germans, really mustn't expect to get away with it again by summoning people to them, handing over documents to them, and forcing them to sign on the dotted line. All that's a thing of the past now. That did it. Hitler instructed Ribbentrop to read out the 16-point proposals to Henderson when the ambassador came that evening, but on no account to hand over the document. At 10:30 p.m., the FA monitored a British embassy official, Sir George Ogilvy Forbes, telling Atolico that they were still twiddling their thumbs waiting for the telegram of reply from London. Precisely at midnight, Henderson arrived at the Chancellery when he inquired whether the German proposals had now been drafted. Ribbentrop arbitrarily replied that they had, but they were now superseded as Poland had sent no plenipotentiary. Ribbentrop read them out to show how reasonable they were. At midnight, Hitler related to all this to Dr. Goebbels. The British, recorded the diarist, are still hanging tough. Not a peep out of Poland yet. The Führer thinks there will be war. Italy's defecation is not all that bad for us, as Italy is the most vulnerable to attack by the Entente powers. The Führer has drafted a memorandum, Danzig to be German, a plebiscite. Wait a minute. Back up there. Danzig to be German, a plebiscite on the corridor in 12 months' time on the basis of 1918, 51% of the vote to be decisive. Loser to get a 1-kilometer-wide corridor across the corridor. Minorities problems to be examined by an international commission. When the time is ripe, the Führer will toss this document to the world community. A few minutes after Ambassador Henderson left, the Führer sent for Colonel Schmunt. At 12:30 a.m., he issued the code word once again, Case White. Immediately after that, he retired to bed. Throughout the next day, August 31st, Hitler was calm and self-assured. He had made up his mind, and nothing now would induce him to change it. The FA knew that Henderson had advised the Polish embassy to telephone Warsaw for urgent instructions. At 8:30 a.m., Henderson had urgently telephoned the embassy again, warning that an unquestionably reliable source had informed him that there would be war if Poland did not take some move over the next 2 or 3 hours. The Polish ambassador Lipski, however, refused even to come to the telephone. Soon after midday, the FA's intercept of Warsaw's explicit instructions to him was in Hitler's hands. Lipski was not to enter any concrete negotiations. He was merely to hand a Polish government communication to the Reich government. Thus the Nazis knew that Poles were merely stalling for time. Lipski went to ground. "He can't be found," recorded Goebbels. "For hours at a time, Poland is obviously playing for time." It worried the minister that Field Marshal Goering, the Luftwaffe's commander-in-chief, was still skeptical, but he consoled himself in his diary. "The Führer still does not believe Britain will intervene. Nobody can say as yet. The SS is given special orders for the coming night." Goering called a ministerial conference at his operational HQ outside Potsdam that day. Secretary of State Herbert Bach recorded, "Today again at Goering's operations HQ. Bormann optimistic. Goering said things look good. Poles want to prevaricate. We are determined. Decision in 24 to 48 hours. Instead of Mussolini, Stalin," Goering mentioned, "publication of something or other that may just keep Britain out. Unfortunately, we forfeited surprise element. Will cost a few hundred thousand more lives. But then we have the upper hand. Need only to defend frontier and west and air approaches to coast from Holland to Denmark, in addition to those to the west. Big danger is to the Ruhr. As the new frontier is short, massive demobilization of troops probable after Poland's defeat, and then relentless rearmament against Britain. There is other evidence of Hitler's beliefs in Colonel von Vormann's notes that day. The Führer," he wrote, "is firmly convinced that France and Britain will just put on an act of waging war." An act of waging war. Then shortly before 1 p.m. on August 31st, the OKW issued Hitler's official executive order for war. When Ribbentrop came around soon afterward, Hitler disclosed to him, "I've given the order. I've set the ball rolling." To this, the foreign minister replied, "And best of luck to you." Hitler instructed Ribbentrop to fob off the Polish ambassador should he try for an interview. Oh, to fob off the Polish ambassador. During the afternoon, Lipski did indeed ask to see whether Hitler or Ribbentrop. Asked to see either Hitler or Ribbentrop. Brauchitsch heard through Canaris of Lipski's request and told Hitler. The Führer replied at 4 p.m. He did not intend to receive the Pole and confirmed that White was still on. When Ribbentrop finally deigned to see Lipski at 6 p.m., he merely asked the ambassador whether he was authorized to negotiate. The interview, the first between diplomatic representatives of Poland and Germany since March 1939, was concluded in a matter of minutes. As the ambassador left, all telephone lines to the Polish embassy were cut. Everything had gone just as Hitler planned. 3 hours later, German radio was interrupted with a broadcast of the ultra-reasonable 16-point offer that Warsaw had refused even to look at. At 10:30 p.m., there were the first radio mentions of serious border incidents, including an armed Polish raid on the transmitter at Gliwice. Other provocations by the Poles were reported near Kreuzberg and Hochlinden. Over 2 million Germans were now under arms, and the dedicated and incorruptible civil servants of the Forschungsamt could see signs that the Western alliance was crumbling. Mansur Kolondry phoned Henderson about Lipski's visit to Ribbentrop and said that the Pole had merely handed over a note without receiving the German proposals, which Henderson had unofficially obtained from Goering that day. Henderson exploded. "But what's the point of that? It's ludicrous, the whole thing." In a later conversation, a heated argument broke out, which ended with both ambassadors slamming down their telephones. On the eve of war, the West was in disarray. And that's the end of that chapter. I'll see you again soon.